This is the Fantastic Books Podcast,
the fantasy and sci-fi book review podcast for fantasy fanatics, book nerds, and lovers of lore and stories.
Covering some of the most loved fantasy series as well as brand new novels.
With your hosts, Anna
and Sam. Let's see what we're reading this week. Welcome back, fantastic listeners. This is Sam.
And Anna.
And this week, we're finalizing the covering of Nathan Ogloff's first book, The Sapien Empire. Nate, I can't believe we're here at the end of the journey for your first book.
The end has come.
Bum, bum, bum.
Just the book one, though. Just the
book
one.
Just book one, yeah.
So last time we were getting ready to build up for the final battle, the Rustraisers were coming in with a plan, and we get to see the big final culmination of all that this week. So I'm pretty ready to just jump right into it. I think since it's the last one, there's nothing to do but talk about how the whole story concludes.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Chapter 23. We begin this section. Kellen and his crew left the off-grid again and decided to go on their own way because the base they had gone to was too crowded, and they're camping along a river.
Yeah, so I think you'd mentioned or foreshadowed a little bit last time that the bases that they were going to get put at when the Domain was reeling back their plans to cover some of the off-grids were going to be potentially too crowded, and so we see the result of this here. They definitely were too crowded, and so the protection of the off-gridders is sort of falling apart a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely compromised.
Yeah. And like Sam said, they're camping along a river here, and a bunch of Rustraisers show up. And obviously, Kellen and his crew are scared and threatened. The Rustraisers have a horrible reputation, so it is only logical that they should be scared. But it ends up being Mastower's crew, and they mess with Kellen a little bit at first. They have this sort of like threatening front, but then they are telling him all about Tersona and how they are protecting the off-gridders there at the ranch. And even though Mastower is explaining all this, Kellen thinks it's a trap. So Mastower has all of his men drop their weapons to the ground and offer them to Kellen, but Kellen is still not convinced by this. Obviously, the Rustraisers are so vicious that one show of kindness is not enough to break all of Kellen's expectations of them.
Yeah, there's so much inherent fear and distrust among the Rustraisers that Kellen and anyone who interacts with them is very wary of like what their next step is.
Yeah, so there's disagreement going on here. So Kellen, at first he's a little bit against it, but then we start to see that he's kind of given up on like having to move so often and being in danger all the time. And he's like, maybe this offer's real. And if not, you know, I'm kind of okay just making my peace at this point.
I think he's at the end of his rope.
Yeah. But he's older. I'm kind of picturing him maybe in his like 50s or 60s. So unlike his nephew, Mattis, who's a lot more confrontational and wants to put up a fight. So they're always sort of the two opposing voices in this group. But unfortunately, as they're deciding what they want to do, the Rustraisers just leave.
Yeah.
So they don't get a chance to make a decision for now.
No. And instead, they bring Tersona, and she says she can offer food, water, and shelter to them in exchange for them working on her ranch. And Kellen ends up taking her up on the offer.
So, at least a glimmer of hope for the off-gridders.
Yeah, life potentially can get better for them, or at least this particular group.
Yep.
And we do get a scene change. It's Engine and Torque, and their crew have left the dam. Engine is thinking how much he was able to push the Domain around with just one captive, and how much damage he can really cause the Domain if he captures a whole group of off-gridders. And, you know, tries to sell him off at a ransom.
Yeah, he knows that the Domain is going to come to their rescue. And he's really riding the high of Marcy's capture and how well he was able to ambush them in the prisoner exchange. So he's got this new plan brewing where he can use the off-gridders against the Domain. So their new plan, like, in order to do this, though, is that they need to get all of the Rustraisers gathered up. And I think you were talking about how many Rustraisers there were last time, but there were like 200 gang crews or something potentially in the world? What was the number?
It was just more like 50. It's not a huge number of gang crews.
Okay. I could not remember that number. Yeah, I mean, 50 is still a lot. That's a good amount to put up against the domain. And so they're going to go visit a Rustraiser shrine so they can talk to that this crew run by a different Rustraiser named Jacker. But along the way there, we don't actually get the scene where they're talking to Jacker. We're getting more of like the build up to it. And Engine's second in command, Torque, is asking him questions. And we're getting this sort of repetitive behavior where Engine is acting a lot like Vibran and saying that Torque needs to learn from him. He's got this plan that he'll be able to convince all the crews to attack the domain, and Torque should just kind of go along with this plan. And then he hopes that when the defeat of the domain is over, he can keep control of all of the other crews so that he can always be in charge.
Yeah, so it's definitely this long con type of plan where he can be the mob boss, so to speak, of all these other gang crews. But this is a very long-term goal, and it all depends on their ability to potentially capture all these off-grids and control the domain. So there's a lot he needs to be able to do before he can make his dream a reality of being, you know, on top of things.
Yeah, you do a little bit of foreshadowing here where he says he has a surprise in store for any gang that decides to be difficult or not agree with him. And later we meet a character who, unfortunately, got the surprise. So
yes,
we get to see what it is later on. But I like that you planted the seeds of that now. We get to see the results later. And then we have one more scene in this chapter, which is a repeat of Jerem going back down into the archive. So I like that they're going back to the archive again and again because she's still looking for answers. But people are still visiting the shrine above it as a religious site as well. They're still dropping sacrifices down there. And I liked that you put in that little detail of how people are still continuing to adhere to this old practice, even though she and Shindo tried to dissuade people from dropping sacrifices down into the shrine. And I was kind of interested in this, like this thought of people not necessarily following exactly what Shindo and Jerem are asking them to do on like a public level. So how do you kind of decide what the general level of like religiousness is or religious behaviors are in your world? Because at the beginning, everyone was super involved in the shrine and now the domain is less involved, but it seems like people are still kind of pulling on this religious background.
So I would say I start with maybe a certain level of religious fervor that maybe you see in certain countries in like Latin America or Africa, where they have like a strong sort of connection to Christianity, and maybe even in the southern US, where I wouldn't say it's evangelical, but there's a strong attachment to it. And then I realize those general trends aren't going to just change in 10 years suddenly. So what I do is I have these gradual shifts where, like, as the standard of living starts to rise, certain people kind of go, well, do I really have to make a sacrifice to the abstract? Is it really exist? Maybe some of this is just me taking my life into my own hands. And so you're going to see a decrease of it, but then you're going to also see people that, you could say, have a certain vulnerability. Maybe they don't have the, maybe they're a little bit more emotional. Maybe they've had, like, that the dice hasn't been rolled for them as well. And so they conclude that there still is an abstract out there that if I do more sufficient prayer, my prayers will be answered. And sometimes these are acts out of desperation, because even though Shindo and Jerem are trying to improve things, it's not something you can just do with the wave of a magic wand. There is no silver bullet solution to a lot of the problems they face.
Mm-hmm. No, I like that. I think it's very realistic the way that you're kind of pulling from like societies, and then like change on a societal level is very slow, even if like technological and infrastructural and government change can sometimes be fast the way they are happening in the domain. But yeah, I like that it's sort of like trickling out slowly as shifts happen more on like a large population level. And I'm interested to see if there's going to be other religions in the world as the like domain expands, or so we know we have the Rustraisers have sort of a different religion, but I'm just intrigued by that.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see down the line of different theologies sprout.
Come into conflict with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Jerem is conflicted and grieving and going to look for research. She's looking for a book called Engineering a Civilization. It has to do with the hydroelectric power, dams, and irrigation. She's having trouble finding the book for a while and, you know, struggles with her faith and confidence as a leader, which I thought, you know, it was a nice parallel, her external struggle with the small task mirroring the internal struggle of her leadership. I thought that scene played out really well.
But she finds the book eventually.
Yeah.
So she is actually there to look up the big dams in the area because she thinks that Krez could be a dam or related to a dam. And we're getting a little bit more information about what Krez could be based on the information she's picked up or heard over the past 10 years, which is that she thinks that Krez will be sort of a technological version of the archive, where they've either stored new technology or they've actually stored information on different types of technology, not just books like they have in the archive. And so as she's doing all of this research, she finds the book Engineering a Civilization. And within that book, she finds that there is a dam that is a research institute, or was before in the Forelaps, and it's sort of close to the domain. So she's thinking that that might be Krez. I'm still not sure if the dam that the Rustrazers have is the one that is the one in the book that she sees here in this book. And I think she's not sure either yet, because she doesn't really find a lot of additional evidence for Krez as the book plays out.
Yeah. Our question for you, Nate, is that the point that they had given up on Krez was because they were too busy with the domain. Was it hard balancing the book to have an overarching plot of finding Krez with smaller plots like rebuilding the domain?
So Krez was actually a concept I introduced later on, and it's actually going to be an analogy for something that we see in the books down the series. I would say in general, balancing a lot of this was just a challenge because you tend to want to focus on just one area, forgetting that you have all these other areas you have to deal with. Working Krez into what I had already had presented some issues, but I always managed to make it. I always managed to figure it out and make it work. And I would say my only problem is just putting in enough details about Krez so that it doesn't seem repetitive as it keeps coming up in conversation.
I don't think it seems repetitive. It feels more like they've kind of stalled out with finding new information.
Yeah, and it feels like a puzzle to be solved, like an enigma.
Right, and I think it's like they keep just finding the same pieces of information over and over, which like is frustrating for them as characters. And as readers, we can see like they need to try something new or need to like get like one last little like puzzle piece to like click everything together.
Mm.
But they're just like not quite there yet.
Also, I wanted to say that it's something she's looking for, but also she doesn't always have the time for it. More often than not, she has bigger fish to fry. So it has to go aside for a while.
Yeah, I think it was like one of those things where, you know, 10 years went by and it's because she was busy rebuilding and doing all this other stuff. And then it's like, okay, now that I've taken care of a lot of this baseline development, I have a little bit more time to look for Krez. But yeah, I think when they first thought, we'll defeat Vibran, we'll get the power of the domain and that'll help us find Krez, I don't think they were expecting it to be this long 10 plus year saga to get there. I think in her mind, she was like, yeah, we'll just like go find it. And it's not how it is. Obviously, nothing is that straightforward. So as we've seen, she's had to deal with so many other things along the way.
Yeah, for sure. Brings us to chapter 24.
This starts with the off-gridders again. And Mattis is at the ranch, at Trisona's cattle ranch, with a girl named Rena. And they are trying to get water. So they've got, it's like a kind of a good show of the development at the ranch. Like they have a water pump, but it's not quite working. So we're seeing how the ranch is developing, but not fully developed yet. And so they can't get water from the pump. So Rena goes to the river by herself to get water, but unfortunately is ambushed by Rustrazers who sexually assault her until Mastower shows up and tries to stop them. But this is going on for a little while before anybody comes to her rescue.
Yeah, she definitely has a very difficult time. And she ends up telling Kellen, and Kellen in turn notifies Trisona of what's going on, where she then punishes the Rustrazer Screw, in turn having him mutilated and castrated over a rack over fire. And so
the domain is still pretty brutal.
Yes. Like, even though we've established a more controlled society we still dole out very severe punishments for severe crimes.
And I think this is, like, the fringes of the domain physically, like, where they are on the map.
Yeah.
And so we can see there's a lot less control in this space, and the Rustrazers have a lot more power to do the horrible things that they do without as much repercussion. Whereas, like, we can see the domain is really trying to push back against that and defeat the Rustrazers so that they can have a more humane society. But, like, with the religion thing we talked about for the previous chapter, like, society doesn't change overnight. It takes a long time, and a lot of the Rustrazers are rotten eggs. And they're not going to change really fast. So a rough beginning for chapter 24 for, I think, all characters involved.
Yes, and during the dole out of this punishment, they change Screw's punishment to lashes, and Rena gets to execute her revenge and take her vengeance out on this Rustrazer.
Yeah, he talks his way out of the punishment because he says he knows what Engine is up to and barters for information at this point.
Yes. Which brings us to a bit of a time jump. And we then have a scene change where we see Jerem and Shindo, and they're summoning Trisona for kind of like a debrief and check-in.
Yeah, they've learned about her ranch, finally.
Yeah, and obviously it's a little bit of a threat to their power structure.
Yep, and Trisona tries to make excuses as to why the travel is taking her a long time, which is obviously because she's coming from her ranch and not her city-state. But they are not fooled. They immediately confront her about the ranch that she's been setting up as soon as she gets to the inner sanctum, which, as we remember, is the room with that electric cage in it. It's a tricky spot because they're saying she didn't do anything illegal, but she did do it in secret, and they're not particularly happy with her. So throughout the conversation, Jerem is activating the cage again and using it as scare tactics on Trisona. And I was pretty surprised by this because Trisona says that, you know, they can take the ranch if that will make them happy. She offers it up to the domain. So I think she realizes that her power would be at least preserved if she hands it over instead of trying to fight Jerem and Shindo. So she's very smart.
Crafty.
But yeah, she's always looking out for her own interests. So I'm still not 100% sure that she won't steer the domain in a direction that maybe is more beneficial to her.
Yeah. Jerem is mad at Trisona, though, and she was mad that Trisona was going to be as powerful as she was and decides to have her arrested. So our little sidebar note on this is that Jerem, you know, is turning into a little bit more of a Vibran-style leader. You know, she's not allowing any of her peers to amass any power that would challenge her own. And Trisona reveals how she made a deal with the Rustrazers that the Rustrazer Mass Tower will tell them all about Engine's plan. So this is Trisona's bargaining chip, so to speak, and allows her to avoid imprisonment or punishment due to their aligned interests against the Rustrazers. And Shindo recommends that they all go to the ranch.
Yeah, so we can start to see how Trisona's pulled in the Rustrazers, at least this, like, quote-unquote better half of the Rustrazers. And Shindo and Jerem at one point said they're going to need somebody as ruthless as Engine to help defeat Engine. So I think the pieces are starting to align here. And we see, obviously, that they do align. But yeah, this little, like, side adventure in the ranch ends up being really helpful because they're able to make allies out of it.
Yeah, and it's definitely the concept of fighting fire with fire. Like, use Rustrazers to defeat other Rustrazers. Mm-hmm. So.
Did you intend for Jerem to become so harsh as a leader? Because I think she has these moments where she can really lash out at people. Or did that just end up being like a product of like her environment in the story?
I would say yes, a product of her environment, just because, like, even though she's, you know, wants to do the morally righteous thing, she also understands that there's certain aspects of a leader that you have to have. And sometimes you have to lay the hammer down, and that this is the kind of world everyone kind of knows, so it's expected, and you really can't settle for anything less because then it doesn't really send the message across. But also, she does only do this to people that she deems as, like, they deserve it, not like an innocent bystander, but somebody that's clearly done something wrong. Like, the punishment should fit the crime, and in this case, she feels like this is the fitting punishment or the fitting the fitting way to go about this.
I think that's fair. I can see why, like, as a leader, you have to have those kind of harsh judgments sometimes. And I think really effective leaders are ones who are not trying to just be everybody's friends, but have like standards and kind of rules and regulations. So I think that's why the domain has been so successful under Jerem. But yeah, you make a good point that she's not really doing it to anyone that doesn't deserve it, where Vibrant absolutely did.
Yeah.
So that brings us to chapter 25. And Injun is still on his rounds visiting all the gang crews, all the other Rustraisers. And he's visiting one now led by a man named Zaust. So we met Mastower and Zaust. Are those names similar to Engine and Torque that are like related to like machinery? Like, are those things that maybe I just don't know?
Yes. So it's actually not pronounced Zaust. It's pronounced Zost, like exhaust.
Oh,
there we go.
Yep. Okay.
Full circle.
That makes sense. Yeah. Cause their society is so like machine oriented.
Mm.
Got it. Okay. That was just a side question. And so Zost, not Zaust, his gang crew lives in this area that is described as like all these steps descending into the ground with all these machines around in it. Is this a mine? I know you had said at other points they have areas that are like kind of like sacred to them.
Yeah, I was alluding to the fact that it used to be a strip mine.
Gotcha. Okay.
Very cool.
Yeah, I like the sort of like industrial spaces like go hand in hand with their culture.
Yes. At one point, Engine comments that they come to places like this to remind us of when the world changed, when the order of things flipped upside down, when those on top couldn't handle it and would rather have a bullet in their head than carry on, when those at the bottom suddenly found themselves in a world made for them. That's why we come here. So, great quote. And our question for you, Nate, is, this is a bit of world building about Rustraiser origins. They seem to be more exploited in the past, and now they see these abandoned places of industry as their freedom. Can you talk a little bit about how you developed this idea?
Yeah, so the idea comes from the fact that usually when societies collapse, everything's flipped on its head. So somebody that, say, used to be a corporate CEO who made like, you know, 6-7 figures a year, when society collapses, well, if you can't really fight and you can't really build anything, you're kind of useless. Whereas people that maybe are on the bottom, they're a little poorer, they might have had a hard time finding work, they have a hard time maintaining their car, they have a hard time, just things feel stacked against them. When stuff like this happens, suddenly, because they're used to having a rough life, they're a little bit more resilient, maybe they know how to use firearms because they live in the country, and they've maybe come from a rough neighborhood, suddenly the world's made for them. And so this is the reason they like it, is because they know their ancestors in the past were getting the short end of the stick, and then when the collapse happened, it was like they were the only ones who could deal with it. It was their time to shine, and so they want to just constantly keep themselves reminded of that. And so yeah, that's where I got the idea for that little bit of world building.
I like that. I like you use that line, like, the day the world was made for us, because they are definitely like the ones who are most resourceful and kind of like resilient in this world.
Oh, for sure.
So after this whole introduction where they're talking about the scenery, Engine is bragging to Zost that he was able to mess up Jerem and threaten the domain by capturing the one captive, i.e. Marcy. And, you know, this is kind of the argument he keeps making. He's like, look, I captured one person and it was so detrimental to the domain. If we can get everybody together and get as many hostages as possible, we can really make a dent in them. So he's just going, go big or go home is sort of his plan here.
Yeah, definitely human heist.
Yeah. But Zost is pretty clever. He's like, you know, Engine, if you're trying to get all of us gang leaders to meet at your dam at one place at one time, who's to say you're not going to just use that to kill us all off and take power?
Which is actually a very good point and potentially a great idea if he was like conniving enough.
Yeah, it could have definitely, if he didn't need all the Rustraisers to fight against the domain, I think that that could have been a different way he could have gotten power from the other crews. But Engine really doubles down. He's like, you know, I am super clever. I was able to take the dam from a different gang crew, which we later learn is Mastower.
Yes.
And so he's clever enough to pull off this plot against the domain. It doesn't make sense to kill all the Rustraisers when the domain is their number one enemy. And we're sort of left with like a non-committal answer from Zost. He's like, well, I might come, I might not. And Engine respects this sort of like non-committal answer. But he's like, yeah, well, you know where to be if you want in on the plot. And then he also reminds us that he doesn't have to use the same gift, i.e. the surprise he mentioned previously, against Chain's gang crew. And we meet Chain later on, and the gift he got was a splash of acid to the face. So, lovely gift there from Engine.
Vile.
Yeah, he's definitely rough. Got no qualms about anything.
No.
So, as we're starting to see, Engine's plot of, like, gathering up people is starting to work. He's sort of convincing some of them, and he's just kind of pushing forward with his plan to keep visiting all the gang crews. So we're getting little snippets in the background of like what he's up to.
Yeah, he's amassing his army, so to speak.
Yeah. Whereas on the other side, Shindo and Jerem are trying to organize the domain a little bit, figure out what's going on with Tersona and her ranch, and then also meet with Mass Tower and start to align themselves with some Rust Raisers on that side.
Yes. Mass Tower tries to negotiate with them for getting the dam back for Engine. He wants the domain's help in getting it back and offers anything in return. And Jerem thinks this could be a trap, which anyone would think that. So I am glad Jerem's just being very candid about this.
The Rust Raisers have not proved themselves trustworthy in her eyes at all.
Exactly. She wants Mass Tower to tell them about all the gang crews siding with Engine first so she can get a better understanding of like what's at play right here. And Mass Tower thinks that if he tells them, they'll just defeat Engine and take the dam for themselves. So again, it's this compromise that's going to allow them to be successful, but either side is having a hard time budging.
Yeah, I like that it's sort of like, oh, well, we need the Rust Raisers to align with us, but then the Rust Raisers want something in return. So it's sort of not like side quest, but it's like in order to get the thing you want, you have to do something for someone else. And like then that kind of brings you somewhere. And, you know, like kind of with like the plot for finding Krez, it's like, well, it's really not as straightforward as Jerem is hoping that it can be. You know, other people's wants and needs and wishes are at play, and she has to keep trying to navigate all of those to move the domain forward. So here, eventually, they agree that Mass Tower will be rewarded if he supplies them with the information. And the information that they're really looking for is how desperate the gang crews are to be siding with Engine. So I think Jerem's thinking, like, what are they desperate for and how desperate are they? And, like, kind of trying to measure the pace of Engine gathering them all together. And another, like, side thought that Shindo's having through all this is that he's wondering if Tersona can actually do the things that the domain can't. Because she was able to help all the off-gridders here at the ranch or their meeting when the domain was not. So I like that we're getting a little bit of doubt from our heroes right at the end in their abilities because it raises the stakes even higher.
Yeah, it's really showing us as readers, you know, this is a larger-than-life issue. Can we accomplish it with more than just like a can-do attitude, so to speak?
Yeah, there's a lot of logistics involved here. So the end result of them going to the ranch and talking with Mass Tower is that they are going to hopefully get Rust Raisers as allies through Mass Tower. And Shindo's actually really surprised by this, but agrees that it could be helpful for the domain to have them as allies. But I like that you end the chapter on this sort of ominous note of him saying he was cautious not to let those expectations cloud his judgment of a future still unseen. So he's trying not to be too optimistic. You know, the Rust Raisers are not to be trusted for the most part. So Shindo at least has his wits about him here.
Oh, for sure. So we proceed with caution.
Definitely.
Which brings us to chapter 26. Here we see that all the Rust Raisers are meeting at Engine's Dam. He and Torque managed to get 15 bosses to agree to join them. So this is a very heavy fortified gathering. As they are gathering, Torque gets worried that the domain will learn that they're all in one place and come to attack.
Which is a very good thing to be worried about.
Yeah, because it puts him in a very vulnerable position.
Yep.
Engine is not worried.
Engine thinks he's unstoppable.
Yeah, there's definitely this sense of arrogance and immunity that he carries with him as of late. That he's untouchable, that no matter what, his plans are going to succeed. So it's an interesting parallel or foil to how our previous chapter ended with Shindo, where, you know, there's so much doubt and caution and fear for being hopeful, where now...
Yeah, Engine's like, I can't be beat ever.
Yeah, like, I'm unstoppable.
Is he inspired by any villains from other media at all?
No, I mean, I would say anything. He's just like the typical, like, let's just say you're watching like a crime film or TV series, and you're gonna have the, like, the boss in charge. Like, you just take that sort of personality, and like that's just what I based it off of. So I would just say any of those types of people, mm-hmm. From like the TV and movies and books I've read. I mean, if anything, maybe if you want to think Ron Perlman from Sons of Anarchy, that'd be a good analogy. Although I only saw one episode of that, so I don't know how accurate that is.
The Big Bad.
Yeah, he's definitely the kind of like in-your-face villain.
Yeah.
Like loud, proud, you can't beat me, I'll do anything, versus like the kind of sneaky...
cold, calculated kind of villain.
Yeah. I think it fits in well with the Rustraiser culture.
Oh, for sure.
Speaking of which, he's reminding Torque that they have quote-unquote balls of doom and all the spikes that they used against the boats before, so that's why he's not worried about being attacked here, because even if the Domain knew they were all going to be in one place, that they are really set up for it.
Yes. And at this point, Zoss shows up. Engine promises them anything when the fight with the Domain is over, because let's face it, there'll be no one to stop us. So again, he's just riding that cloud nine of arrogance and thinking the world is his for the taking.
Yeah, but sneaky, sneaky Chain, who's the boss that Engine had to use his gift on, the gift of acid, and Mastower are watching all these Rustraisers gathering up at the dam. So they're like perched up on one of the cliffs on the side. They've got binoculars, and they are keeping track of what's going on. And Mastower is gathering up this information on behalf of passing it to Jerem. Chain just wants revenge because of what Engine did to him. He just didn't really agree to the plot, and Engine thought he could do anything, including pouring acid on him. So even though he is distorted and burned from this acid, Mastower is saying, like, hey, don't care what you look like because we're Rustraisers. Like, when have we ever cared about that kind of stuff? But then also, B, you need to use your face as, like, a symbol of why Engine needs to be taken out.
Yeah, so definitely, like, an act of martyrdom, so to speak.
Yeah, a little rallying cry, like, of why Engine is so dangerous. Like, if he'll turn on the other Rustraisers, like, he can't really be trusted.
Yeah.
And from their perch, they see Rustraisers and cannons. Rustraisers setting up cannons and machine guns. So they are definitely fortifying the dam. They're preparing for a fight. And now our guys, Mastower, has this information.
Yes. And here we get a scene shift to Shindo. And he's in his factory watching over the construction of the vehicles he had thought of last time due to the Crown's help.
Yeah, the amphibians.
Yes. As he's watching, a scout comes with an urgent message. So he goes to meet with Jerem. And Jerem had the same message, which tells him about Engine's meeting of Rustraisers. And she asks Shindo how the amphibian vehicles are coming along, because they'll need them now. And unfortunately, Shindo only has about 20, which is nowhere near enough.
No, I think she's like, how many do you have? 50? 100? And he's like, yeah, it's just 20.
Five?
Like, so, it's, like, it's definitely not enough. I really like that you're kind of stacking the odds against the good guys, because then, you know, it's a kind of come from behind fight at the end.
Yes.
But because they only have 20, Jerem's like, all right, we're going to have to call upon Mastower and the Rustraiser allies that we now have, because we don't have enough force on our own. And she's actually pretty smart. She's like, I don't want to move any of our own soldiers and troops towards the dam and leave the off grids and the bases open to Rustraiser attacks, which is really smart, because in the next chapter, we learn that Engine's plan is to have all of the bases and the off-grids attacked, each one by one Rustraiser crew. So it's a good thing that they didn't move all their soldiers towards the dam, because that would play right into Engine's hands.
That, and I think they've learned from enough war tactics from the Rustraisers to anticipate a lot of subterfuge and sneak attacks and ambushes. So they are, you know, definitely being more conscientious of that possibility.
Yeah, it's almost like what they learned from the attack where they made all the explosions at the front of the base, but all the guys were sneaking in the back.
Yeah, exactly.
So they're getting smarter.
I think their tactics definitely are being a little bit more thought out.
I think so, too. And then the other reason that Jerem wants to call upon Mass Tower is because he knows every detail of the inside of the dam, since obviously he used to control it. It used to be his. And they're hoping that he can help them navigate, figure out where would be points that Engine would set up traps or ambushes within inside of it. So they're going to have to trust Mass Tower, even though he's a Rustrazer. So I like that they are dividing the Rustrazer lines and not just saying all of them are bad or all of them are good. There's a lot of nuance here as to who can and can't be trusted.
Yeah. And our question for you, Nate, was when creating all these different social groups within your world, was this a theme that you knew you wanted to implement from the beginning of, okay, obviously these Rustrazers are very brutal warrior-like people. How would it be to have them work towards a common goal? Or was this a idea that developed as you were orchestrating the plot?
Well, I had to do it in order to make things work together so that this final battle made sense. But I also knew near like the latter half of working on this that I wanted to have, they were just kind of united by this common sort of like idea of just freedom and riding the wandering the land without any sort of like anything attaching them. But also I knew that they weren't going to be united under one person. It's kind of like I guess you can say Scottish clans, I guess like a long time ago, where before they had a kingdom, it was just sort of like they're united by an idea, like they have a common identity, but they're not under one person. And also I didn't originally call them the Rustrazers, like in the early drafts of this. I just called them like raiders from the interior. So I wanted this sort of third mercenary group that really just nothing too extreme is beyond them. They're willing to do anything. It's kind of like Viking berserkers, if all of them were just berserkers, like just that like nuts mentality of don't hold back. And so yeah, all of that is the process behind which I created these people. And I knew I was going to need a villain in the interior, because once they had taken out Vibrant, I knew that these people were going to be left over. And so I knew that they were going to be there, and then the domain was going to have to contend with them, why they exist in the novel.
How'd you come up with the name Rustrazers? Because I really like it. I think it fits really well.
It's catchy.
I think it's because when you think about collapse in a society, it's like everything's turned to rust. So you've raised rust up from nowhere because it wasn't there, and now it's risen up. So I just kind of played around with it, like I do with so many of my words. And I came up with Rust Razors, and I was like, yeah, I like that idea. It's rolls off the tongue quite
nice. Yeah,
definitely
does.
I was going to say that too. I like the name for it. Oh, so, speaking of the Rustrazers, it is the final chapter. We're about to get the final confrontation, and all of the Rustrazers have gathered.
Yes.
So it is now July in the year 13, just to keep track of like where we are. So 13 years since Shindo and Jerem took power.
Yes.
And it is summertime, which is important in a few minutes because it starts to rain, and it's a very unseasonable situation, which just adds like an X factor into the fight.
Yes. And we see that Engine has all his bosses gathered up to go over his plan. He has a map of all the off-grids, and he's assigning one to each boss to capture and take hostages. So we're going over his like master plan, so to speak. And the time that they want to execute this plan is the next dark moon, which I think strategically is brilliant. You know, you'll have the cover of night to aid you. And it's a good way for all of the other crews to know when to coordinate the strike, because although the domain has a way of keeping track of the year, I imagine Rustrazers aren't part of this like national calendar system.
Yeah, I don't think they're really keeping time.
You know, they're definitely more primal and, you know, maybe a little less sophisticated as far as like tracking days and time.
I don't even think they would need to.
Yeah. So I just like that that was like tucked in as a little piece of information for them to coordinate the attack.
Mm. Another reason I think it's smart is because Zost is like, hey, what are we supposed to do in the meantime? And Engine says, just kind of act normal.
Yeah.
You know, roam around, do what you normally do until it's time for the attack. And then the plan is to essentially overwhelm the domain. And even if the attacks aren't all exactly at the very same moment, it's going to be like report after report after report coming into the domain of off-grids getting captured. But this whole conversation is interrupted by an announcement from Torque.
Yes. And he says that the domain has the weird boats and is worried that it's going to rain. So...
yeah. Engine's a little annoyed. He's like, why did you interrupt me? Like, if the domain is sending a boat down the river, like, go take care of it.
Yeah.
And the smoke will hide us anyway. But as we see in a few minutes, the rain actually dampens the smoke so that their forces are completely exposed.
Yes.
So after this interruption, Engine goes back to talking to the bosses. And the bosses are actually all worried that they are not going to be able to capture an off-grid. They're saying, you know, Engine, you captured that one last time, but the domain has gotten a lot smarter since then. They are prepared for attacks from Rustrazers. I don't know if we can do it. So Engine's actually pretty smart. He says he's picked out bases that were ones that the domain pulled back from. So the, all that plot from before of the off-gridders feeling abandoned as they had to, like, reconsolidate actually plays into this whole final plan of Engine's, because he's like, hey, we should attack the domain at these points where they don't have any soldiers.
Yeah, so this leaves them vulnerable to attack, and it inspires the Rustrazers to be more motivated to follow through with this.
Yeah, I think it's like easier than attacking the domain itself.
Yeah.
And he is playing on the domain's emotions, essentially saying, like, they're gonna come help the off-gridders, like, they're not gonna just leave all these people abandoned when we're attacking.
Right. I'd be like, okay, the good guys are gonna do what they do best and act in a noble interest for all, and yeah, they can exploit that.
They're gonna play the hero for sure.
Yeah.
But as this meeting is concluding, they are being attacked at the dam right now. So, like, yes, the fight has come right now. Engine's plan is not gonna get put into action. But Engine tries to make the best of it. He's like, great, this is an opportunity to show all the other bosses what a good fighter and leader I am. I don't think he realizes, like, this is, like, the might of the domain at his doorstep right now.
Yeah, I think he was just like, oh, it's going to be like a skirmish and we'll show them. We'll send them running with their tails between their legs.
Yeah, yeah.
And sure enough, things definitely play out a little differently. Two mines go off, but our fleet of amphibians just move to land and travel. And it really goes to show Shindo's engineering expertise at the forefront again, the way these vehicles glide over all terrain.
When you were coming up with the ideas for Shindo, like, did you have, because obviously, like, the final fight was going to be at the dam where the Rustrazers are. Did you have this idea of creating vehicles that could go on water and land to, like, bring the fight to the dam? Or did you end up deciding to have the fight at the dam later on and then making Shindo have to, like, navigate that problem solving?
So this fight was planned for a while because I did want to have kind of a final crushing blow to the Rustrazers, at least as a major player. And so I had this idea of Shindo invented the amphibians because they needed some machines that could quickly go over land and water because there's a lot of portaging and rapids along the river courses they usually take. Mm. And so it's actually based off of something called the Marsh Screw Amphibian from Chrysler from the 1950s or 60s. But combined with that, I had this idea of it would be so cool if you had, like, this fleet of amphibians going down the river and Engine thinks he has the upper hand. And then what happens is they part. He thinks they're retreating, but then they go over land. And so it's a sudden shock of, like, I wasn't expecting that. And as we see it later, like, the idea of that then one of the amphibians then turns to the side, starts going sideways as the cannon and machine guns are just going off on the Rustrazers. So, yeah, it's been in the book for a while through multiple drafts.
I think it's really creative to have a fight at a dam. That's not usually, like, where final battles happen. Yeah, and I like you just said, they totally thought they had the upper hand. And then, you know, these amphibians are like, okay, great, there's mines in the water. We'll just walk right up on the land.
Cool, thanks.
Yeah, so as soon as Engine sees that, he realizes this fight is going to be a lot tougher than he thought. He says all of the gang crews, all the men there have to fight. So it's now turned into like a full-on big battle, big final battles happening. And Jerem and Shindo are here in the amphibian as well. Jerem is there to coordinate the attacks, and then Shindo is there to make sure the vehicles operate properly. So our two main good guys are also in the thick of the fight.
Yes, and this is just a full-on firefight, you know, with cannons and guns, and the Rust Razors are trying to attack back. They're able to destroy most of the Rust Razor cannons because of the fact that the Rust Razors are stationary and these amphibians are just so versatile and able to move. They definitely have the advantage.
Yep.
They're able to climb on top of the dam, and Jerem's nervous because she thinks Engine prepped his defenses because they knew they were coming. But Shindo's less sure. She thinks Mass Tower withheld information from them. And it's hard because, you know, I genuinely believe Mass Tower is acting altruistically, but because of his Rust Razor ties, Jerem just does not fully trust him.
Right. And so she's like, hey, they had cannons and stuff ready for us. Mass Tower, did you put us into a trap, essentially? And Mass Tower is there. All of him and his Rust Razors are on the other side of the dam. They pulled up in boats. So Jerem, before proceeding into what could be an absolute trap if Mass Tower double-crossed her, goes down and I love this. She just punches him right in the face.
Yeah.
Like, she has no patience for this. She cannot afford to walk into a trap with all her men and Shindo there. And so she just takes it right up and punches him in the face and tries to get to the bottom of this. So Mass Tower says that it's obvious that Engine would have known they were coming because, like, you know, you marched this whole army over here and he's got his own eyes and ears, his own spies. So I think that's probably what happened. But I think it was good for Jerem to check and make sure that they weren't going to be completely ambushed when they got stuck inside the dam. And then Mass Tower additionally tries to placate Jerem by saying that the rain that has come is actually helping them. You know, it's dampening all this smoke so we can see what's happening. Perhaps it's a sign from the abstract that's like blessing your actions. You know, it's giving you its favor.
Yeah.
But Jerem makes him go one more step and prove his loyalty by sending a Rust Razor in with each of her platoons into the dam.
And again, this just kind of parallels so many times throughout this book. We've had characters having to prove their loyalty to their, like, leader or commander, and now it's Mass Tower's turn to kind of prove that. So Jerem and Mass Tower are inside the dam and they find a trip mine immediately, and he's like, see, I just prevented you from getting blown up. Am I not loyal?
Yeah, it seems like it'd be a really tense fight because I've never been inside a dam, but I imagine that they're probably pretty like labyrinthine, and because, you know, they're like huge machines inside. So it seems like it would be really tough to navigate the inside of one. I don't know. Have either of you been inside a dam?
I haven't.
I can honestly say I have not. I'm just basing loosely what it would look like off of various photos I've seen. And that one scene in Vegas Vacation when they go to a dam. So, but yeah, I don't know what they look like in detail.
I think the only thing I can think of that I've experienced is there's like a museum near us that has decommissioned battleships, and I went inside the submarine and it's like so tight and small in there. And that's kind of what I'm imagining them like trying to,
like, catwalks and like,
yeah, yeah, it's like not an easy place to fight. It's really pretty tight and then twisty turny like pathways, and
yeah,
it's, yeah, so it's a tough terrain for sure.
Oh, definitely. And you know, they go in through this dam to approach the main chamber. Mass Tower says that they need to use a smoke bomb because if they throw a real one, it'll risk the dam collapsing. And no one wants that, obviously, because everyone will get washed out.
Yeah, he does actually use a small bomb in here, even though he said not to, and defeats the Rust Razors in this room. But he's like, I only knew that because I know the dam so well.
Yeah.
And I know that there's enough stone underneath us to support this, but like nowhere else. No bombs anywhere else. Yeah. So he is proving really helpful. He's a great ally because he's been able to navigate them through this area so well. And we see that again in this next room too, where they confront Zaust.
Yes.
Zaust.
They confront Zaust and they're stationed there to fight him. They light a fire in the room and block both exits. And anyone that runs out gets killed. So things are just truly, pun intended, heating up.
It's definitely like a massacre of the Restorators. Like, they are getting taken out pretty efficiently by the domain. And as we see, like, at the kind of final count at the end of the battle, it's a big hit to them. Like, this is a big victory for the domain. They take a lot of the numbers of the Restorators out.
Yes. Their Ploons take over and what seems to be the whole dam, but nobody had any reports of finding Engine.
Dun, dun, dun.
So, Mast Tower is celebrating because he gets his dam back, and Jerem reminds him he only gets to keep it as long as he keeps passing them information on the Restorator gang. So, there's a alliance, but not the strongest of cooperation. So, this leaves things open to have change in the future.
Yeah, I'm not sure how long Mast Tower will stay aligned with them now that he's gotten his dam back. He aligned with Tersona because he was desperate before, but yeah. I like that you're leaving it sort of like an open alliance and like that could change, especially with all these power dynamics changing. And in this conversation, when Jerem is reminding him this like agreement that they have, he's like, oh, yeah, but the Restorator crews right now are they've all taken a big hit because of this fight. So like I can keep tabs on what they're doing, but like they won't be doing much.
No.
So he brushes her off a little bit, which could be.
Could
tricky.
Be trouble in the future.
Yeah.
They do find out that Engine had escaped through a water tunnel. And they're like, crap, you know, we're so close to taking it over and making sure that Engine had nowhere to run. But he's a crafty, slippery villain and escaped.
Yeah, they only found his second in command, Torque, who's the one who eventually, through torture, told him that Engine escaped. So they definitely hit the Restorators hard, but Engine is still in play, so villain keeps continuing into the story, even though, like, the whole situation has changed for the Restorators.
Yes. And they also find no evidence of Krez either. So, a couple of dead ends on their pursuits at this time. You know, a lot has been resolved, but this keeps things open for subsequent stories and mysteries to unravel.
Yeah, like the long-term goals are still open.
Yes. There's a great quote here. None of it should have been surprising. The road to Grez, as Shindo would say, was long, broken, and rough. Jerem saw that it was also faded and overgrown, with meandering directions not always easy to find.
I like that that's...
It's like a questing.
Yeah, and I think that's how Shindo kind of originally thought of Grez, as like a mythological place or like a state of mind almost, and that there's no way to actually get there. So like he's saying it's long, broken, and rough because like, you know, you're always suffering and it's tough. Whereas Jerem sees it as faded and overgrown, but something that's faded and overgrown can still be found and picked up. And I think that's like sort of her perspective on Krez/Grez, that like if she looks hard enough, she will find it.
Yeah.
And we get a last little bit where we see what Engine is up to after his great escape.
Yes. So Engine is fleeing the area, is not able to regroup the other gang crews because most of them have either formed deals with the off-grids, have been decimated by battle, or are permanent enemies of him. So he's in a very tough position. Engine reveals that his new plan is to go undercover into the Domain Society and destroy it from within, which is brilliant.
So he picks this young Restorator named Clutch from somebody else's crew to become one of the infiltrators because he's so young, he doesn't have like tattoos and piercings yet that would immediately identify him as a Restorator. The book ends with this line from Engine where he says, "Don't worry about me. I know what's out there waiting for the domain to come and find them." So you leave us with a lot of like possibilities for the future because of the situation between the domain and Mast Tower. We've got Engine's plan to infiltrate the domain, and then Engine here leaving this sort of tidbit of like, I know what's out there past this world that we've seen in book one. There's more, you know, the domain's going to come find it, and there's just like a lot more that can be explored.
Yeah, so it definitely allows us to keep guessing and, you know, be interested to see what happens to our characters with future installments.
Yeah. So I think like my main big like book takeaway, like the lesson of the book, I think, is to like not give up, and that like the path to where you're going isn't always straight and straightforward. But if you come at things with creative solutions, you'll find the path eventually.
Oh, yeah. That's an awesome takeaway.
Thanks. Is that kind of like what you want readers to take away from your book? Are there other themes that you really, I guess, kind of want to promote with the book?
I think what I want people to take away is that, like, we all want the world to be a better place. And because our world is complicated, complicated problems require complicated solutions. And I want to just have people understand in depth what it takes, especially with Shindo and Jerem. I want people to understand that as a leader, even if your intentions are the purest, sometimes it's just you can encounter problems that have no straightforward solution. And no matter what you do, you're going to piss someone off. The whole point of this series is really, I've heard Carl Sagan and Neil deGrasse Tyson say that we've got a lot of potential if only we could get over our petty squabbling. Well, this series is basically that process in action. And I go into detail as to, I almost want to lay out a formula for what does that look like on a day-to-day, on a person-by-person basis. So in general, that is my premise and what I want people to take away from this series.
I think that's awesome. It's super like altruistic. And I like that you took that quote of like that one you just said of like, we could have a lot of potential if we could get over our squabbles. And you're like, well, yeah, like what would a world look like if that could happen? And I think that's the power of fantasy and sci-fi, to be able to play around with those sort of like world building and like social rules. And you're starting from a world that's probably as messy or messier than our own in terms of like how rough some of these societies are. So it's cool to see the way that characters navigate those conflicts and those differences.
Nate, one final question for you. Any highlights, things that you've learned as an author writing your first book?
I've learned a lot. I've learned that you have to be wary of who you take advice from. I've learned that this basic premise that I started with is a lot more complicated and nuanced than I thought. I learned that writing a novel series and finding yourself as an author takes a long time, especially if you're working a full-time job. One of the lessons, I think the biggest one, is this is within anyone's reach. And don't think you can't be an author because, you know, you're not sophisticated, quote unquote, or you don't think of yourself as a respectable person, quote unquote, because I, in the beginning, associated this with fine art. And I thought like someone was going to just tell me like, you're not qualified to be in this industry. But after talking to a lot of authors and putting my book out there and having basically just feeding it to the fire, so to speak, I've learned that I am qualified to do this. I'm not a bullshitter, despite what I initially thought I was. It's a testament to the power of just sheer motivation and the desire to not stop and see something through until it's done.
Well, that's amazing. And truly, congratulations. We are so glad we were able to cover your story and be a part of this journey with you. It's been so much fun being able to see what happens to these characters week after week, and thoroughly just really enjoyed the experience.
Yeah, I think dystopia is not, I guess this like kind of falls into dystopia, but it's not usually a genre I gravitate towards. But I really enjoyed like the sort of like human nature you put into the story. I feel like it really was a good twist on that genre that I think for me, like I connected a lot more with that than I would some other sci-fi books that I've read, which are a lot more heavy on the science part. Whereas this is a lot more about like the human condition within a tough kind of world.
Yeah, definitely a lot of silver linings and messages of like hope and perseverance.
I thought that was great. And it was exciting to see the final end and the battle and kind of like where we ended up with 13 years of Shindo and Jerem being in power and like what they could accomplish in that time.
Yeah, I'm excited to see what has plans for the domain in the future.
Oh, yeah. So do you want to one last time tell everybody where they can find your book and buy your book and follow along?
You can find a lot of all of that off of my website, nathanogloff.com. But to go into detail, I'm on Twitter, Instagram. I got a Facebook page called The Forge Work of Nathan Ogloff. On Twitter at Unusual Author. Instagram and TikTok at Nathan_Ogloff. And then you can get my books off of Amazon, Apple Books, Google Books, Nook, and Kobo. And up here in Canada, Indigo Chapters as well. Thank you.
Thanks, listeners. If you're looking for more, check us out at fantasticbookspod.com, where we have book reviews, reading list suggestions, merch, and you can even send us a message.
Or find us on Facebook and Instagram at Fantastic Books Pod.
And if you like what you've been hearing, don't forget to leave us a review.
Thanks.
Golden Rise Media.